I didn't realize I was wasting $415 a month until I downloaded Rocket Money. I thought I had my finances under control until the app laid out all my spending and categorized it for me. Takeout, shopping, and unused subscriptions were quietly draining my account. And as a result, my savings took a backseat. But Rocket Money doesn't just tell you what you're wasting money on. It takes action to save you money. First, the app looks at your income and monthly expenses and calculates how much you can safely spend each day to stay under budget. Rocket Money also finds and cancels unwanted subscriptions for you and even negotiates better rates on your bills, so you have more money in your pocket. On average, Rocket Money members can save up to $740 a year when using all the app's premium features. Users love the app with over 186,000 five-star ratings. It's time to simplify your finances and take control of your money. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Disease hit hard this year, huh?
Yeah. Mother Nature threw the kitchen sink at us. Tar spots, southern rust. We had everything.
I didn't know if my fungicide would hold, but Miravis Neo really came through. Even with that dry spell, our yield monitor did not disappoint.
Seriously?
Yep. And with results like this, I'm sticking with it.
No matter what next season brings, protect your ROI with Miravis Neo. Call your retailer to lock in your supply today. Always read and follow label instructions.
And it came to pass, when the children of men had multiplied, that in those days were born unto them beautiful and comely daughters. And the angels, the children of the heavens, saw and lusted after them, and said to one another,
Come, let us choose us wives from among the children of men, and beget us children.
And Semyaza, who was their leader, said unto them,
I fear ye will not indeed agree to do this deed, and I alone shall have to pay the penalty of a great sin.
And they all answered him and said,
Let us all swear an oath, and all bind ourselves by mutual imprecations, not to abandon this plan, but to do this thing.
Then swear they all together and bound themselves by mutual imprecations upon it. And they were in all 200 who descended in the days of Jared on the summit of Mount Hermon. And they called it Mount Hermon, because they had sworn and bound themselves by mutual imprecations upon it. And these are the names of their leaders: Semyaza, their leader, Arachlabah, Ramiel, Kokabel, Tamlel, Ramlel, Danel, Ezekiel, Barakiel, Asael, Amaras, Batarel, Achnanel, Zachiel, Samzapil, Satarel, Turel, Jomjael, Sahriel. These are their chiefs of tens.
Hello, citizen. This content creator is a confirmed conspiracy theorist and has been subject to repeated penalties for spreading controversial rhetoric. Please proceed with caution. Trust the government. Remain silent. Your compliance is appreciated and, of course, non-negotiable.
Hey everybody, welcome to the 21CD podcast. As always, I'm your ghost, John. I just wanted to hop on here quick and just say thank you everybody so much. Everybody who's been sharing the show, to all my OGs, I see you out there doing work. You guys are awesome. To all you new people, hey, don't be scared. Cozy up next to daddy. We're about to get into some hairy stuff.
And they were in all 200 who descended in the days of Jared on the summit of Mount Hermon. And they called it Mount Hermon, because they had sworn and bound themselves by mutual imprecations upon it. And these are the names of their leaders: Semyaza, their leader, Arachlabah, Ramiel, Kokabel, Tamlel, Ramlel, Danel, Ezekiel, Barakiel, Asael, Amaras, Batarel, Achnanel, Zachiel, Samzapil, Satarel, Turel, Jomjael, Sahriel. These are their chiefs of tens. And all the others together with them took unto themselves wives, and each chose for himself one. And they began to go in unto them, and to defile themselves with them. And they taught them charms, and enchantments, and the cutting of roots, and made them acquainted with plants. And they became pregnant, and they bore great giants, whose height was 3,000 ells, who consumed all the acquisitions of men. And when men could no longer sustain them, the giants turned against them, and devoured mankind. And they began to sin against birds and beasts and reptiles and fish, and to devour one another's flesh and drink the blood. Then the earth laid accusation against the lawless ones. And Azazel taught men to make swords and knives and shields and breastplates, and made known to them the metals of the earth and the art of working them, and bracelets and ornaments and the use of antimony and the beautifying of the eyelids and all kinds of costly stones and all coloring tinctures. And there arose much godlessness, and they committed fornication, and they were led astray and became corrupt in all their ways. Samyaza taught enchantments and root cuttings. Amaras, the resolving of enchantments. Barakial taught astrology, and Kochkabel the constellations. Ezekiel the knowledge of the clouds, and Arachiel the signs of the earth. And Shamsiel the signs of the sun, and Sariel the course of the moon. And as men perished, they cried, and their cry went up to heaven. And then Michael, Uriel, Raphael, and Gabriel looked down from heaven and saw much blood being shed upon the earth, and all lawlessness being wrought upon the earth. And they said one to another, "The earth made without inhabitant cries the voice of the cryings up to the gates of heaven. And now to you, the holy ones of heaven, and the souls of men make their suit, saying, Bring our cause before the Most High." And they said to the Lord of the ages, "Lord of lords, God of gods, King of kings, and God of the ages, the throne of thy glory standeth unto all the generations of the ages, and thy name holy and glorious and blessed unto all the ages. Thou hast made all things, and power over all things hast thou, and all things are naked and open in thy sight, and thou seest all things, and nothing can hide itself from thee. Thou seest what Azazel hath done, who hath taught all unrighteousness on earth, and revealed the eternal secrets which were preserved in heaven, which men were striving to learn. And Samyaza, to whom thou hast given authority to bear rule over his associates, and they have gone to the daughters of men upon the earth, and have slept with the women, and have defiled themselves, and revealed to them all kinds of sins. And the women have borne giants, and the whole earth has thereby been filled with blood and unrighteousness. And now, behold, the souls of those who have died are crying and making their suit to the gates of heaven, and their lamentations have ascended and cannot cease because of the lawless deeds which are wrought on the earth. And thou knowest all things before they come to pass, and thou seest these things, and thou dost suffer them, and thou dost not say to us what we are to do to them in regard to these. Then said the Most High, the Holy and Great One spoke, and sent Uriel to the son of Lamech, and said to him,
"Go to Noah,
and tell him in my name. Hide thyself, and reveal to him the end that is approaching, that the whole earth will be destroyed, and a deluge is about to come upon the whole earth, and will destroy all that is on it. And now instruct him that he may escape, and his seed may be preserved for all the generations of the world.
And again the Lord said to Raphael,
bind Azazel hand and foot, and cast him into the darkness, and make an opening in the desert, which is in Dudael, and cast him there. And place upon him rough and jagged rocks, and cover him with darkness, and let him abide there forever. And cover his face that he may not see light. And on the day of the great judgment he shall be cast into the fire, and heal the earth which the angels have corrupted, and proclaim the healing of the earth, and they may heal the plague, and that all the children of men may not perish through all the secret things that the watchers have disclosed and have taught their sons. And the whole earth has been corrupted through the works that were taught by Azazel. To him ascribe all sin. And to Gabriel,
said the Lord,
proceed against the bastards and the reprobates, and against the children of fornication, and destroy the children of fornication and the children of the watchers from amongst men, and cause them to go forth. Send them one against the other, that they may destroy each other in battle. For length of days shall they not have. And no request that they make of thee shall be granted unto their fathers on their behalf, for they hope to live an eternal life, and that each one of them will live 500 years.
And the Lord said unto Michael,
go, bind Semyaza and his associates, who have united themselves with women so as to have defiled themselves with them in all their uncleanness. And when their sons have slain one another, and they have seen the destruction of their beloved ones, bind them fast for 70 generations in the valleys of the earth, till the day of their judgment and of their consummation, till the judgment that is forever and ever is consummated. In those days they shall be led off to the abyss of fire, and to the torment and the prison in which they shall be confined forever. And whosoever shall be condemned and destroyed will from thenceforth be bound together with them to the end of all generations, and destroy all the spirits of the reprobate and the children of the watchers, because they have wronged mankind. Destroy all wrong from the face of the earth, and let every evil work come to an end, and let the plant of righteousness and truth appear, and it shall prove a blessing. The works of righteousness and truth shall be planted in truth and joy forevermore. And then shall all the righteous escape, and shall live till they beget thousands of children, and all the days of their youth and their old age shall they complete in peace.
This month, Israeli forces took control of a Syrian outpost at its peak. When the Syrian government collapsed, Israel and U.S. forces moved in swiftly, their actions precise and deliberate. Is this a strategic operation, or does it signal the start of something much larger? Mount Hermon's history is layered with tales of the divine and the catastrophic, and now it stands as a stage for what could be a pivotal moment in a rapidly changing world. Timothy Alberino, a prominent writer, researcher, explorer, and all-around badass, has done tons of work on this topic, and I find myself aligning with him on many matters. I have for a while. As you guys know, may or may not know, of course, we are big fans of his book Birthright, as well as the Book of Enoch that he actually put out with Blurry Creatures. So yeah, love Timothy Alberino in this house. And his discussions about Mount Hermon delve deeply into its theological, mythological, and potentially esoteric significance as a focal point of interaction between the divine and human realms. So, Alberino emphasizes Mount Hermon as the site where the Watchers, a group of 200 fallen angels, descended to Earth according to the Book of Enoch. And that's why I read you guys the Book of Enoch, you know, First Enoch, is because I wanted you guys, I feel like a lot of times people are like, oh, you should go check out the Book of Enoch, and people are really hesitant to do that because it's not Bible canon. But there's a lot in the Bible that backs up the Book of Enoch, and there's a lot in the Book of Enoch that backs up the Bible, and, you know, we're not going to go down the whole rabbit hole of why you maybe should give the Book of Enoch a chance, but either way, for the sake of this episode, we're giving it a chance. This episode was requested specifically because of the recent capture by Israeli forces of Mount Hermon, so it's kind of a big deal. 200 watchers, and they wanted the human women to, one, marry and copulate with them. They want to progenerate their own type of offspring. They want to put very young into God's creation. They want to insert themselves as if they were any other member of, I guess, life. I don't know what their real goal is. Maybe just what we have to them is literally just so good. I don't know. It's very alluring for some reason. But inferred by Alberino is that another one of their goals is to usurp dominion of the earth through the agency of their hybrid offspring. And it gets pretty nuts. Alberino suggests that Mount Hermon was more than just a physical location as well. It acted as kind of a cosmic gateway. There's literally a portal there, a metaphysical bridge, or yeah, like some kind of portal allowing celestial beings to sort of traverse between realms is at Mount Hermon. And the idea of a gateway ties into the broader concepts in ancient theology, where specific geographic sites are seen as like liminal spaces. On this podcast, we call it the dimensional bleed, where you can traverse, you can for a brief moment be in both dimensions at the same time before completely traversing over to the other side, or it swallowing you up, or something like that. And Mount Hermon is one of those locations. It's not only significant spiritually, but also strategically. And this would have been true, as true way back then as it is today. It's a towering peak overlooking Israel, Lebanon, and Syria, and it's considered a key military vantage point even today by whoever holds it, which is now Israel. Alberino hints at the possibility that this strategic importance could also have ancient roots, with the site chosen for divine incursions due to its prominence and visibility. Indeed, there's not really a peak like it around it. Mount Hermon's location and prominence could align with ancient traditions of building temples or ziggurats as symbolic mountains of the gods, and these were thought to be points where gods actually descended to commune with humanity. So when you think about all those pyramids and ziggurats all over the world from ancient times, ask yourselves, what's really going on here? Were these gods continually descending to Earth to manipulate the human race and, you know, engage with the women and produce more offspring and make more creatures and stuff like that? I think so. I think that's 100% possible. And I think that's one of the reasons for certain races that just go completely extinct and nobody really knows why. Like
Take, for instance, the Anasazi or the Cahokia. What happened there? That stuff is crazy. Now, in Alberino's view, the Watcher's descent represents not only an invasion, but also a colonization of Earth by non-human entities. This act fundamentally changed the spiritual and physical fabric of the world, necessitating divine interventions like the Flood, right? He also connects the location to ongoing spiritual warfare, saying that it could remain a significant spiritual hotspot, or even an active portal. And we're going to get into why. There's some crazy stuff to follow. Alberino theorizes that Mount Hermon might still hold relevance as a cosmic gateway, including not just spiritual narratives, but also potentially modern geopolitics, right? The recent conflicts and military operations in the area could, in this view, actually reflect deeper hidden motivations, right? Tied to the site's ancient legacy and the stories and the mythologies and the tales and everything that points to this place being sacred. Alberino explores the intersection of biblical narratives with modern phenomena like UFO sightings. When this episode was requested, it was specifically interesting to me because of the UFO stuff that's also going on. I think that's tied to what's going on at Mount Hermon, believe it or not. You're like, how could that be? Well, we're going to get into it. I think it's linked somehow to almost all these extraterrestrials that we're seeing, or a lot of these extra-dimensional entities. I think it's responsible for more than you would expect. And these entities could be using Mount Hermon as a gateway for interactions that parallel the ancient accounts that we've already seen, that we've already got stories of. Why would they not be doing the same thing? You got to think, a lot of these stories could also be viewed as sort of an instruction manual. A lot of these written in oral histories, right? Instructions. So as part of his apocalyptic framework, Alberino also discusses the possibility of a resurgence or reactivation of these gateways in what he calls this post-human apocalypse, where ancient beings might return to sort of influence or challenge humanity. And maybe that's true. I'm not saying that's true. I don't believe everything that Alberino believes, but I believe a lot, and that's why I'm using so much of his words. And I know a lot of you guys also listen to Alberino, so I want you guys to definitely know I would never in any way try to rip off this man, because he is a legend. Alberino frequently ties Mount Hermon to a broader narrative of cosmic geography, where certain places on Earth, like Mount Hermon, Baalbek, and the Temple Mount, serve as intersections between the physical and spiritual realms, and these locations are thought to hold both ancient and modern strategic significance as well for celestial warfare and divine plans. So, through his work, Alberino kind of paints Mount Hermon as a symbol of rebellion and a literal and metaphorical high ground in the cosmic struggle between good and evil. It's a very important place. It's not just a mountain. It's not just someplace in Syria. It's a portal. It's a battleground, and perhaps a key to understanding the mysteries of humanity's ancient past, like seriously, and maybe even their uncertain future. And the splicing we mentioned, these hybrids being made by the Watchers. We've mentioned splicing before in the podcast. It's believed that these Watchers engaged in this kind of activity to make hybrid beings out of us and animals. And it's most likely technology, guys. And it probably looked like magic at the time, and I'm sure there were some spiritual powers at play too. These were spiritual beings, but it appears, especially when looking at many old carvings and glyphs and paintings and Sanskrits and writings, that these Watchers may have actually come on UFOs. And that's another way that we can tie it in to everything that's going on today, because there's something wrong with what's going on today. The stuff that they're telling us today doesn't make any sense, especially in regards to these UFOs and these aliens and all this hogwash that they're trying to feed us, giving us little teeny tiny sound bites of what's actually going on, because it is a
layers upon layers upon layers deep brainwashing that's going on. You're being brainwashed without even realizing you're being brainwashed. There's a running theory that when Nephilim die, their spirits, seemingly immortal thanks to their Watcher genetics, continues, and they basically become demons. What does this have to do with Mount Hermon? We're getting to it. They hate these Nephilim, they hate humans now. Like, you realize that. It's not like in the ancient times before all the wars broke out and everything when they were sort of working with humans. Now, they hate us now, and they can basically possess anything. To survive the Flood, a number of them, this is a new idea that I've just kind of been thinking up a little bit, is that maybe a number of them actually skinwalked themselves as a giraffe or something onto the Ark. I mean, not literally as a giraffe, but they may have infiltrated the Ark in some way too, you know? And if they're able to produce offspring in the same way that the Watchers were, then they could, you know, prolong their lineage. Perhaps some of the animals that were on that Ark were not supposed to be there because they were hybrids, and maybe this was an accident on behalf of Noah. He wasn't perfect. He did run into some obstacles. And the Watchers' descent to Mount Hermon might symbolize a deliberate act to intervene in human evolution, introducing their own genetic material into the human population. This would align with conspiracy theories suggesting ancient alien intervention or manipulation of early humans, and it also aligns with my NPC theory, which states that basically we are pretty much always surrounded by Nephilim because they are so intermingled amongst us all that we don't even realize when we're talking to one. I'm serious. And there's several episodes on my channel about the NPC theory. Choose any of them. The Raphaim and the Anakim, seen as the descendants of the Nephilim, could represent further generations of hybrid beings, possibly the result of continued experimentation to refine or perfect these hybrids. And remember, guys, these beings are wildly intelligent, these Watchers. They know how to manipulate stuff. They know how to get stuff done. And their intelligence is beyond ours. So if they're able to do this stuff with ease, think of what else they could do. It's important to realize that the Watchers could not do any of this, however, without establishing a type of agreement within the laws of man. It appears that they needed us to allow them permission. And it's unclear how at this point. It may simply still be a part of what God was saying when he said that we would judge the angels. But one way or another, the Watchers don't appear to just be able to seize us and take us or whatever. We have to agree for some reason, for in some way. There has to be a contract of some sort. And this really gives us a fascinating nod to, you know, like the meeting the devil at the crossroads and even the vampiric legend of needing to be invited in. These appear to be examples of Nephilim or Nephilim adjacent activity. So human men traded human women to the Watchers for something, and it was most likely technology, and it was most likely knowledge and wealth. And forbidden tech and forbidden knowledge combined with insane wealth is a recipe for disaster. So in exchange, the men gave them their women. But it appears that there was some kind of actual bank as well for humans, and there was a like a lineage that would be given over to the Watchers that was sort of made to be sold of these women, and this was a big deal. This was basically like global human trafficking to the gods, pretty much. It's not something that was taken lightly or some kind of weird situation. It was a big deal out in the wilderness. Very well thought out transaction. And these women may or may not have actually given birth to these beings. I've heard the stories of how they exploded upon birth and stuff like that. But again, I align with Alberino, I think, where these giants,
when they were given birth to, were probably the size of a normal baby. And then they just kept growing after they were out. And they were getting bigger and bigger and more powerful. And these beings should be thought of like Hercules, like Medusa, like Nike, like the Silver Surfer, like these guys who are just gods. Man, they're smart, they're powerful, they're heroes to some people, they're just these magnificent beings. They aren't creatures that bumble around in the caves with a big loincloth on and this huge log that they've got over their shoulder, and they hit stuff with it, and sometimes they trip and they fart and they burp and all that kind of stuff. That's not what we're talking about here. These are spiritual entities with human qualities that possess the powers of both. There's hosts of tales for them too. And we're just choosing to close our eyes to all of the mythology because we don't see it as history for some reason. Because science calls it art instead of history. So you might be asking, it sounds pretty in-depth, are the Nephilim still here today? Absolutely, man. They're all around you. Some of them are orbs, in my opinion. And some of them, these orbs, some of those I do believe may be Nephilim spirits. And some of them are people that look just like you, but they're not human beings. They're something else. Some of them are celebrities. Some of them are on TV as TV hosts. You guys see them slip up every now and then. Some are CEOs, and some are presidents of entire countries, and some are just lying in wait, literally in the forest somewhere, under a rock, in a cave. I fully believe you could happen upon one of these beings. And this is all part of the UAP disclosure that they can't truly give you on the full scale, because it would blow your mind and it would fracture reality. I feel like it's forbidden knowledge that just can't be released. It's too much. And if you think all of this just sounds way too crazy to be true, have you ever heard of the very true and very real Chimera? Chimeras are organisms composed of cells. Science lesson. From two or more genetically distinct individuals, and the term originates from Greek mythology, where the chimera was a fire-breathing hybrid creature, often depicted as part lion, part goat, and part serpent. In modern science, chimeras are fascinating and a controversial topic, involving biology, genetics, and even speculative discussion about ethics and identity. So, there are several ways that chimeras can occur, both naturally and artificially. There's a tetragametic chimerism, and sorry guys, I know you guys hate it when I can't pronounce words, but I am only human. It is a tetragametic chimerism, that's the phrase, and it occurs when two fertilized eggs merge early in development, forming a single individual with two distinct genetic lineages, and this can result in unique traits, such as different DNA in various parts of the body. And then we have microchimerism, and that's during pregnancy. A small number of fetal cells essentially can cross the placenta and remain in the mother's body, and vice versa, creating a subtle form of chimerism. And some animals can develop naturally as chimeras as well, particularly when multiple embryos fuse during development. And this results in creatures with mixed genetic material. And then, of course, we have the classic human animal chimeras. You didn't think this was real, right? You thought all this was Stranger Things. But these are literally created in laboratories by combining human and animal cells, typically for research purposes. But if we're researching it, I'm sure we're researching the full extent of it. And we only get to hear about basically none of it. So, for instance, human stem cells may be injected
into animal embryos to study diseases and develop organ transplants or explore genetic engineering. In 2021, researchers created a human monkey chimera to study early human development and test the limits of organ compatibility. This is happening. Like, this is real. And people are always like, oh, how could the Watchers be splicing? What does that even mean? They had advanced technology. What are you talking about? It's not even that, like, advanced. Or if it is, like, we have it too. Like, when people say this stuff is unrealistic, it's like, how and what part? Scientists can also create chimeras by fusing embryos from two animals of the same or different species. For example, a geep, G-E-E-P, is a chimera of a goat and a sheep, created by merging their embryos. Gene editing technologies like CRISPR, have you guys heard of that, have accelerated the creation of chimeric organisms. Because scientists can now, like, modify DNA in ways that blend traits across species. We can literally invent animals. And that's exactly what the Watchers were doing. If we can do that now, what could the Watchers, in all of their wisdom and all of their intelligence, do? And don't mistake me for saying that they have the best wisdom and the greatest wisdom, and we should be following all their wisdom. No, we shouldn't, and that's the problem. We are, and we're splicing things, right? We mentioned in Greek mythology, the chimera was sort of this monstrous hybrid creature with the body of a lion, the head of a goat, and a serpent's tail. We've been talking a lot about Greeks lately, but guys, this is all Watcher technology, and there were very powerful Watchers in charge of Greece, and then later Rome, and now the Vatican and Italy, and it's just like, this is all connected to these Watchers on Mount Hermon, and this tech is Watcher tech. The fingerprints are all over it. And the Nephilim are also not the only hybrids mentioned in ancient texts. And by the way, we even had one of those questions by one of the politicians, might have been Lauren Boebert, but she said something like, are we attempting to resurrect or replicate the Nephilim through genetic splicing, or is there any kind of like genetic splicing going on or something like that? And they were like, basically like, we don't know. But the fact of the matter is, it was brought up, and that is crazy that this was brought up at all and put on TV. That means people in politics are talking about this. But anyway, the Nephilim are not the only hybrids mentioned in ancient texts. We also have centaurs, and we have minotaurs, we have sphinxes, we have all these creatures in Greek mythology that could be seen as evidence of widespread stories of animal and human hybrids. These beings that are not just creatures of story. They existed at one point. And the Book of Enoch also describes fallen angels teaching humanity about modifying nature. If I was to keep reading, that's what you would hear. And that could extend to manipulating humans and animals as well. Look at all these humanoid cryptids out there. It's almost out of control. We've got Dogman, we've got Mothman, we've got Bigfoot, we've got, I mean, the list goes on. You know, like, almost, it seems like most cryptids are somewhat human hybrid in a way. Why is that? Why are all the big ones human hybrids? It's because they are probably remnants of spliced creatures from this time period, or they're continuing to be manufactured. They're coming out of hiding. Who knows? I think these things are going to be making much, much, much more physical, visible appearances in the near future, though. I've been saying that since I started this podcast. I think in the near future, you will be more weird for not seeing a cryptid than you will be for having seen one. So embrace your sightings, people. Let's get back on track. In the Nephilim narrative, their creation was kind of seen as a direct violation of God's natural order, resulting in the flood as divine judgment, right? Because they were literally taking over the planet. We had to smite these guys, and so God did. And genetic splicing raises significant ethical and spiritual questions with God as well, I'm sure.
So, are we repeating the sins of the Watchers? Is this really that far-fetched of an idea? I don't think so. Mount Hermon's mystical reputation has drawn attention from UFO and paranormal researchers as well. It might feel like, where are we right now? We're outlining the importance of Mount Hermon and attempting to answer the question of why Israel took it when they weren't at war on this front. That's the question. It's a big deal. Because Israel is surrounded by enemies, and in the middle of Syria, the rebels overthrowing their Russian dictator. I know he's not Russian, but overthrowing their Russian place dictator, only for Israel to just swoop in with the help of the United States and seize Mount Hermon. That is fascinating behavior, boys. Does it have anything to do with all this? What about these UFOs? Is this a critical aspect in all of this? Because these theorists suggest that Mount Hermon is just a hotspot for UFO sightings, and I think we could tie that to fallen angels and the beings that are in this area attempting to use Mount Hermon or using Mount Hermon in ways that we don't understand. And this might be one reason why there's a UN base up there, making sure nobody else gets it. You guys remember that there's a UN base on the top of Mount Hermon? That seems like a minor obstacle. And it's kind of weird, don't you think, that Trump, who's a big ally of Netanyahu, is also threatening to pull out of the UN. The US, of course, provides most of the power that the UN actually has. So Israel is also very PO'd with the UN. And I have to ask myself, is this the beginning of the severing of ties between these nations and the UN? And they're starting with seizing this mountain from them. What kind of future does this spell for the world? As I said before, UFOs and orbs, they've been seen in the area regularly. And some have ventured to wonder whether or not orbs are the literal visible spirits of Nephilim without bodies. So a Nephilim dies, a giant dies, and an orb becomes in one way or another. Right? Literally, they would be demonic presences. They would be demons, essentially, visible before latching on or manifesting into something. Because what are demons, guys? Like, demons aren't just these little creatures that live in hell, like we are raised up to believe. Everybody who's listening to this podcast knows that that's not what demons are. What are they? I mean, I don't know for sure, but I'm guessing it's the spirits of these Nephilim. And these, they sometimes manifest as these orange spheres of light, according to this theory. And they're very strange and elusive, and they'll often approach, but never get close enough for you to fully see what they are. Sometimes, though, you can catch glimpses of faces within them. A viewer recounted to me how he once saw one with a snake-like head, complete with a single visible eye, and it briefly popped out, looked around, and then slipped back into the light. What? So there's something more to orbs, in my opinion, and these orbs are incredible at hiding. They blend right into the ambient light around them. They're there, and you don't even realize that they're there, and they watch you. And here's the thing, if you shine a light at them or something like that, you might actually see them just vanish. When they act erratically and they flee and they, like, a lot of that is responding to probably some kind of action that's being put upon them. You shining a flashlight, you seeing them, you pursuing them in an airplane, anything. A lot of people believe these orbs are more than just strange lights, too. Even people who don't believe that they could be demons. But as I said before, many Christians and researchers, and including former FBI agent John D'Souza, thinks that these entities are demonic and not extraterrestrial, not aliens from outer space. And D'Souza, along with some investigators from MUFON and even members of Congress, suggest that they are indeed tied to the Nephilim, and those spiritual beings are mentioned in ancient texts. So now we're starting to realize that the narrative unravels a little bit with this suggestion. The idea is that the Nephilim don't have physical bodies anymore, so they create them using materials from things like abductions and animal mutilations. These beings, according to D'Souza, can shapeshift into whatever form they need. Whether that's a person, an animal, a light, or something else entirely. There's even talk that the military doesn't try to seriously engage with these orbs, knowing full well what they might be. It's not that they're afraid of them, it's that you can't fight them with conventional methods. You can't shoot them down or catch them. These aren't your typical nuts and bolts UFOs. There's something else entirely, operating on a level that we don't fully understand. And orbs and UFOs have been being seen, I think you'll agree with me, on a scale that increases in its magnitude daily. Everybody is seeing this stuff now. It's all over social media. You used to be crazy if you had an orb story or something like that. So was Alberino right? Are these the Elohim? Are these the Watchers finally returning on their craft? It also coincides with the orb's attraction to craft in many instances, in my opinion. Maybe these orbs need a UFO for some reason. Maybe they're pilots. I think I mentioned that in the last episode. It's this idea that these orbs are pilots in some way. And if they are the disembodied spirits of these Nephilim who need hosts of some type, baby, we got pilots. But it's not just the orbs and the UFOs that are making a staggering comeback, right? This is just a tasty morsel. But there is a place known as Banias, nestled at the base of Mount Hermon, of course, and Banias is an Arabic pronunciation of Pan, by the way. Yes, Pan. It was once a city devoted to the half-goat, half-human Greek god Pan. And this was a deity of wild nature, fertility, and unfettered lust. And Pan's mythology and his worship here were nothing short of shocking, involving rituals of uninhibited sexuality and animalistic behavior, all performed in the belief that they would summon the god's presence. Pan was also a god that demanded human sacrifice. And you might be kind of confused right now. Don't worry, I was too, because Pan is Greek, right? So why does he have such a fan base in Syria, specifically at the base of Mount Hermon? Well, it all ties into this gradual spread of influence. The Watchers, who took on the identity of the Greek gods, later the Roman gods, distributed across the earth. This is the reason, in my opinion, that there is Greco-Roman architecture all over the world, including a dominating presence in the United States. Because these Greco-Roman Watchers, these Watchers who identified as Greco-Roman gods, went there and planted their flag. That's what they did. And so, yeah, they established a temple at Mount Hermon, the most sacred mountain possibly on the planet. It's not that far-fetched of an idea. This was a very powerful group of Watchers, and they knew all about Syria and Mount Hermon. They were there. They fell. Pan also became associated with Caesarea Philippi, which is a city located at the base of Mount Hermon, and it's far from its traditional Greek homeland, obviously, and this association arose during the Hellenistic period when Greek culture spread into the Levant. The sanctuary at Caesarea Philippi, known as Panias, modern Panias, was dedicated to Pan and included a grotto, a spring, and temples. This was a beautiful place. The spring that emerged from the cave was considered sacred
to Pan. And the grotto was believed to be an entrance to the underworld. Guys, this is the most magical thing you can imagine. If you go on my YouTube, you will see some recreations of what it looked like. This grotto was no ordinary cave. It was thought to be a literal gate to the underworld, where fertility gods retreated during the winter, and worshippers would gather at the nearby shrine, engaging in acts many would consider depraved, to coax Pan's return in the spring. For the Romans, this was Caesarea Philippi, a city built by Herod the Great's son, Philip, in honor of Tiberius Caesar. It became a hub of pagan worship, complete with marble temples and shrines carved into the cliffs. This Mount Hermon with all of the temples is just evidence of how so many gods are battling for this location or want their graffiti on the wall. For Christians, however, this place took on a very different meaning. It was here, amidst the debauchery and idol worship, that Jesus spoke a prophecy to Peter. Here's a passage from Matthew 16, 13 through 19. When Jesus came to the region of Caesarea Philippi, he asked his disciples, "Who do people say that the Son of Man is?" They replied, "Well, some say John the Baptist, others say Elijah, and still others Jeremiah or one of the prophets." "But what about you?" he asked. "Who do you say I am?" And Simon Peter answered, "You are the Messiah, the Son of the living God." And Jesus replied, "Blessed are you, Simon, son of Jonah, for this was not revealed to you by flesh and blood, but by my Father in heaven. And I tell you that you are Peter, and on this rock I will build my church, and the gates of Hades will not overcome it. I will give you the keys to the kingdom of heaven. Whatever you bind on earth will be bound in heaven, and whatever you loose on earth will be loosed in heaven." Imagine the shock of Jesus's disciples as they stood in this infamous city of ritual impurity. Caesarea Philippi was no place for devout Jews. It was a city of sin. It was Sin City, steeped in practices that these Jews would have considered abhorrent. They couldn't even cast eyes upon. And yet Jesus chose this very location to challenge his followers, to proclaim that his message would overcome even the darkest forces of idolatry and perversion. And it was here that Peter recognized Jesus as the Messiah. And it was here that Jesus symbolically laid the foundation for a spiritual revolution. So Christ planted his own temple right there, and he called it Peter, baby. "I tell you that you are Peter, and on this rock I will build my church." Right there, in the middle of this city of sin. It's insane. After declaring that Peter was the rock, Jesus took Peter, James, and John to a high mountain, possibly Hermon. It's the highest one in the area, where then the transfiguration took place, which of course was a moment of divine revelation. The connection between the divine and the demonic, the holy and the profane, it seems to resonate throughout Banias, this area of Mount Hermon, which, again, now Israel controls in totality. It feels like a prophecy, guys. Even in its ruins, Banias speaks to the uncanny persistence of its myths. The limestone cave, which collapsed in 1033 from an earthquake, this cave of Pan, the gate to the underworld, it still looms there, and you can go there. But it's no longer that gushing spring that it once was. It's been silenced. And Pan, who is known for triggering sudden, inexplicable terror, hence the word panic, still seems to sort of linger in the air in the area. And even when you watch videos, it just feels weird. Look it up. It's weird. But the earthquake is fascinating to me. The earthquake that struck Banias and its surrounding region in 1033 was a catastrophic event, leaving destruction in its wake. And I had to research this in depth because I thought it was wild. It altered the landscape of one of the most bizarre sites in the ancient world, this Banias area. And the earthquake is believed to have been a major seismic event, and it violently shook the region around Mount Hermon. The limestone cliffs that housed the Grotto of Pan trembled as the ground beneath them heaved. The once majestic Grotto of Pan, revered as a gateway to the underworld, was partially obliterated as massive chunks of the cliff face collapsed. Boulders the size of small houses thundered down into the valley, shattering on impact and forever altering the grotto's appearance. The accompanying sound was deafening, a combination of the earth's grinding, the crack of splintering stone, and the roar of collapsing structures. Dust and debris filled the air, obscuring sunlight and plunging the area into eerie twilight. The spring that once gushed forth from the grotto, feeding all of the lush vegetation and giving life to the nearby settlements, was choked off by falling rock and sediment. Silencing the flow. Man, that's awesome. And you really gotta wonder what happened, right? Was this a spiritual battle where God was just like, you know what? Watch this. We have this once towering, awe-inspiring limestone cave just completely reduced to a collapsed shell of its former glory. And it doesn't look like much now compared to what it was. So whatever hit it real hard. And you can find intricate carvings in the cliff face and places where statues once were and all that kind of stuff. And there's still relics buried within the cave, they believe. The Temple of Pan and the Dancing Goats, which was built around 220, suffered irreparable damage. Its columns crumbled completely, and the courtyards where worshippers once gathered for rituals were buried under fallen stone. The Temple of Tiberius Caesar, which was constructed in 16 BCE, was reduced to ruins, with fragments of its grand architecture scattered across the whole area. The city itself, which was perched near the grotto, was absolutely devastated. Buildings collapsed, streets buckled, and survivors were left wandering amidst the rubble, searching for loved ones and attempting to salvage whatever remained of their lives. Now, of course, historical records of the earthquake are sparse. You pretty much got it right there. But it is mentioned in regional chronicles of the medieval period, and chroniclers described it as a devastating event that shook the Levant and left entire cities in ruins. And while Banias was not a major urban center at the time, its religious and cultural significance ensured that its destruction was noted. And the earthquake marked the end of Banias as a thriving pagan and cultural site. So that really does make you wonder if there was just a little battle going on and the forces of good got one that day. It's really interesting to think about these things because that's what's going on around us all the time. And that's what we're sometimes pulled into as well. And this whole area was just gradually abandoned and then, of course, later turned into a tourist site and all that kind of stuff. But so some say that the cult of Pan was extinguished here by the rise of Christianity, and they see that as sort of a prophecy that Peter triumphed over Pan. But is that what it is truly? You know, we see where all these pagan idols once were, and now all those locations are empty. But there's still the energy there. It's like I told you, when you look at it, you can kind of feel it. Is this place a portal? Was it closed off because it's the portal? Is the portal the cave, and it was sealed by an angelic war. So what is Pan, though, and why is it important that we talk about Pan in this episode? Pan is a half-man, half-goat god, right?
He was satisfied through human sacrifice. And the sacrifices at the gates of hell were basically performed by throwing the human sacrifice into a natural abyss of underground waters. And if the body didn't come out the other side at the back of the cave, then the sacrifice was just considered accepted by Pan. But if blood appeared in the river or the nearby springs, the sacrifice was rejected. So put this in the context of the ways that we sacrifice humans today. Humans we don't want. Sometimes they're immigrants. Sometimes they're impoverished. Sometimes they're from war-torn countries. Whatever. I don't need to go and describe to you all the different types of people that are murdered, killed off, snuck away, sold away, distributed. Really gives you a whole different concept to the idea of Peter Pan, doesn't it? Who's based off the god Pan. Stealing away children. The signs are everywhere. All you have to do is open your eyes and see them. But around the period of this earthquake, something really interesting happened. The Druze faith, spelt D-R-U-Z-E, was emerging as a distinct religious group based on the teachings of Al-Hakim and his successor Hamza ibn Ali. And the Druze community is fascinating, and I had never heard of this religion before, and I had to go down the rabbit hole, and I'm bringing it up to you, and it might be nothing, but I bet you haven't heard of this before either, so just give it a shot. But they established themselves in the mountainous regions of the Levant, including areas near Banias and Mount Hermon. And I find this interesting because they exist where these watchers descended, similar to all of these other temples and all of these other churches and these religious fingerprints all over this mountain. And now there's this mysterious Druze religion as well. So I find the location fascinating. And I find that history and documents about this area have largely avoided mentioning this religion. So that makes me want to know more about it. The Druze faith is a unique and esoteric monotheistic religion, and it originated in the 11th century CE in the Middle East. It's distinct from Islam, Christianity, and Judaism, though it incorporates elements from all three, as well as from Greek philosophy, Gnosticism, and some other traditions. And the Druze faith is known for secrecy, with many aspects of its theology and practices kept hidden from outsiders and even from Druze who have not reached a certain spiritual maturity. And it went through a lot of changes over the course of however many years and solidified itself as a belief set and all that kind of stuff. And it really, you know, refined the crude edges to become this monotheistic religion with an ineffable God who is beyond human comprehension. And they believe in a highly philosophical and mystical interpretation of religion, focusing on like things like inner truth, divine revelation, over literal adherence to scriptures, stuff like that. And their sacred texts, which are known as the Epistles of Wisdom, are only accessible to initiates who have undergone spiritual training. So it's like a religion that's a way of life, and that also is fascinating. A cornerstone of Druze belief is reincarnation, where every soul is reborn in a continuous cycle of life until it achieves spiritual perfection. Kind of like the Nephilim. They just keep coming back, don't they? They reincarnate in a weird way, right? I mean, obviously, that's not the first place most people are going to go, but that's where my brain went. God's presence is expressed through the universal mind, an emanation that connects God with creation. And the Druze emphasize morality, honesty, and loyalty. They believe in equality between men and women and advocate for strong community bonds. It's really crazy because they sound like a weird combination of both good and evil, and that gives this religion a very strange place, I guess, because it feels distinctly like a fallen angel. I that's what I'm trying to say. I'm trying to say it without saying it, but I'm just going to come out and say it. It feels like that is a fallen angel who didn't really catch the bus and was kind of left behind or came later or was, you know, beat up on real quick or something like that. A smaller
angel, fallen one, watcher of lesser status who is trying to make his mark in this area with this religious group. And we could go on and on about the Druze because I did a pretty deep dive, but they have a deep connection to their land and to their communities, and they are loyal to the countries that they are in. Often, they serve in local governments and militaries. Now, the Druze have their own religious scriptures, as we already mentioned, the Epistles of Wisdom, but they don't have converts. You must be born into the Druze faith. You don't become a member of the Druze community by converting to it. There's about 1 to 2 million of them worldwide, primarily in Lebanon, Syria, and Israel. And then there's smaller communities in Jordan and in some other places. But one of the interesting details about them is that they form a significant minority and play an influential role in politics, with guaranteed representation in the governments in the countries they're in. So, what does that mean? Are they militarized? How are they a significant and influential group in politics? Why haven't we heard of them? They're recognized as this distinct religious group in these political schemes and these political circles, and many Druze serve in the Israeli military, unlike other Arab populations in the country. The Druze have maintained strongholds in the Jabal al-Druze region and have historically enjoyed autonomy, although they have faced challenges during Syria's civil war. To outsiders, they are weird, and they have beliefs that are weird. And on the inside, they have an unwavering commitment to their identity and their connection to sacred lands. Fun fact, perhaps the most famous member of this community is none other than Amal Clooney, who is George Clooney's wife. But among the small and secretive ranks of this strange religion are members with significant contributions to literature, politics, music, academia, and international law. So they are very important, and they're just this little sort of militarized, political, religious group that lives in the region of Mount Hermon that nobody has ever heard of, that apparently is a big deal in the area. Since this belief set came later, it's possible that the fallen one who potentially created this religion, we're just speaking figuratively here, is a relatively new addition to the spiritual war that is raging on this planet for one reason or another. And maybe that is related to this invasion in some way on behalf of Israel without them even knowing it. Right? But we know he's not on our side. And I'm sorry to take you on that little side quest, but I just thought it was absolutely fascinating, and by giving it to you, I encourage you to go do your own research and find incredible answers to some of the questions that you may be searching for, okay? So, what did we learn today? Mount Hermon, a name that translates to essentially devoted to destruction, carries this legacy since basically the dawn of time. And according to the Book of Enoch, it's the mountain where these 200 fallen angels bound themselves together to carry out their rebellion against Yahweh. But did they really grasp the magnitude of their actions? As with all things concerning the Creator, it's a matter of the spirit and the breath of life. The story doesn't end there. After the flood, the Nephilim reappear. Some speculate that one of Noah's sons' wives may have carried their lineage, but it's hard to imagine Noah missing such a detail on the ark. He may have also somehow missed the fact that maybe one of them shapeshifted into an animal or something like that. Another theory suggests that demons, the spirits of the dead Nephilim, just somehow persisted in ways we don't understand. These spirits, devoid of life and love, exist only in torment, seeking power by devouring human spirits or inhabiting us in some way, living through us. This cycle of corruption and destruction spreads through immorality as the Nephilim spirit enslaves the human soul from conception, eventually becoming the demons that haunt the world. This might sound far-fetched, but it aligns with accounts from former occult practitioners who have turned to faith in Jesus. They testify that demons are indeed the disembodied spirits of the Nephilim, a terrifying remnant of that ancient evil. So why does this matter now? The 200 fallen angels responsible for this atrocity were imprisoned in the abyss before the flood, allegedly, for 70 generations. Many believe that time has passed and their release occurred over 200 years ago. Maybe some have escaped. Maybe some were let out and we weren't told about it. Maybe some others have fallen. Most definitely others have fallen. But if that's true, it explains much about the horrors that we've seen since. All these wars, this destruction, and the rise of spiritual corruption. In the end, it all points to the abyss where Abaddon in Hebrew or Apollyon in Greek emerges. Both names mean destruction. This is the tribulation, a time where the battle intensifies. Survival depends on faith in Jesus, obedience to Yahweh's commandments, and the courage to resist, even unto death. And yes, the Nephilim's influence is here, stronger than ever. They hide behind the veil of modern horrors, abortion, starvation, and suffering. Every child lost becomes fuel for Abaddon, strengthening the true enemy, one who is anti-life and relentlessly destructive. When humanity grows scarce, their hunger turns to the beasts of the earth, consuming everything, all in their path. This has happened before. This was the reason for the flood. So we can't stand idly by. Feed the children. Teach the commandments, not as chains, but as a blueprint for survival in these times. The fight is far from over. It's just beginning. But with faith and action, we're going to win. All right, guys. Hope this hit the spot. I know you guys like the Watcher Talk. Don't forget to give us a like, give us a follow, give us a share. Tell us about what you like in the comments. Do all the stuff that you do. And I will see you next time. Don't drink the water and question everything.
Did you know that parents rank teaching financial literacy as the toughest life skill? That's where Greenlight comes in, the debit card and money app made for families. With Greenlight, you can send money to kids quickly, set up chores, automate allowance, and track spending with real-time notifications. Kids learn how to earn, save, and spend responsibly, while parents have peace of mind knowing smart money habits are being built with guardrails in place. Try Greenlight risk-free today at greenlight.com/trygreenlight. That's greenlight.com/trygreenlight.
Planet Fitness has everything you need to start strong, so you can give everything you've got. From plate-loaded strength equipment and functional training areas to treadmills, stair climbers, and free weights. Our equipment is best in class, and our clubs are right around the corner, so you can make this your strongest year yet. Join the club today and save $28 or more when you join for $1 down, $15 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends Friday, January 9th. Are you coming? Planet Fitness. We're all strong on this planet. See club for details.
Disease hit hard this year, huh?
Yeah. Mother Nature threw the kitchen sink at us. Tar spots, southern rust. We had everything.
I didn't know if my fungicide would hold, but Miravis Neo really came through. Even with that dry spell, our yield monitor did not disappoint.
Seriously?
Yep. And with results like this, I'm sticking with it.
No matter what next season brings, protect your ROI with Miravis Neo. Call your retailer to lock in your supply today. Always read and follow label instructions.